Every life is consequential. The question becomes whether it's consequential for good things or consequential for bad things. But every life is consequential. There is no life that doesn't have some kind of an impact upon the world in which it exists. Every life does. Now, maybe not in some kind of transcendent way where everybody kind of looks at that life and says, wow. Although you could look at a person's life that is consequential in a great way and say, wow. And I have looked at another person's life that did terrible things and I said, wow. I mean, I think that we can say wow in both instances. There isn't a person in this room whose life has not been and is and will continue to be consequential in some way. It's the way in which God has created the world. The question that lies before every believer is, will my life be consequential for something that is good, or will my life be consequential for something that isn't good? I mean, that is in essence, in principle, that is the way in which that we are judged. We have the primary judgment about whether or not we can enter into heaven for all of eternity. That's the first judgment. And then as Paul makes very clear in 2 Corinthians, every man's work will be judged by fire. And if what he has done is burned up, then he himself will receive loss. But he will have just gotten in to heaven. I'm paraphrasing terribly, but that's basically what it says. How do you want to enter into heaven? Do you want to enter into heaven as if you just barely got in? I mean, it's sort of like when you're being chosen for a sports team and somebody has to pick you. And you're the last person. Do you get on that team and think, wow, this is great, I made it. Or are you kind of embarrassed by it? I'm overstating it, but you get my drift. Your life is consequential. Your life matters for good or for bad. It matters. And one of the things that we do in order to make our life consequential in a good way is by being committed to overcoming bondage in our life and in the world. And we all have our bondages, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit more. So on the next slide, I was thinking about this as I was driving in. Vitally, there is a direct correlation between our own personal bondage with sin and our ability to be a Christian of consequence for relieving the bondage in the lives of those around us. The more we overcome the bondage in our own life, the more we can be consequential in relieving the bondage in other people's lives. If we have a lot of bondage in our own life, it gets in the way. Bondage can be like this anchor that you just drag behind you. Bondage can be something that covers over your life so that people can't see the light of Christ through you as well as they should be able to see. Bondage gets in the way. So this next slide is what I was thinking about when I was driving in. When we are not committed to overcoming our own bondage, we enable others to become better in their own enslavement to sin. When we are not committed to overcoming our own bondage, then we enable others to become better in their own enslavement to sin. Because the effects of our bondage encourages them or doesn't discourage them from the sin in their own lives that enslaves them. In some respects, this has been the problem of the church throughout the 2,000 years in its existence. Certain Christians who refuse to deal with certain things in their own life send a terrible message to other people who might have received that message had they not seen those terrible things in a Christian's life. So, what I want to just challenge us in a good way is just by saying, look, we all have this. I have mine. Just recently, I don't know about you, but sometimes when I get on internet, I can just look at those reels, just, and I become fixated on and I can spend hours just watching those reels, and it can become kind of a bondage, and you can waste a lot of time looking at those reels, you know? And I found that after a while, it was beginning to impact my ability to think. And I was reading too much online. And reading online is not the same as sustained reading with the book. It just isn't. And it really impacts you. So for the last two months or so, I needed to rehabilitate myself from that. Because it was really diminishing me in my ability. I mean, my job is to be able to articulate things. That's part of my job. I need to be able to do that well. And if I can't, then I can't do my job well. So I've been rehabilitating myself over the last couple of months, and I've read about 6,000 pages of just books so that I can just get my mind back because of how I was too much preoccupied with these other things that seem harmless enough, but they really do diminish. I'm not saying they're bad in and of themselves. I'm saying the practice of them too much is bad in and of itself. I have this story. Many of you know how much I love a guy named C.S. Lewis, and he's been a literary mentor of mine over the course of my life. I've probably taught this book over a dozen times, a book called The Great Divorce. And in that book, the premise of the book is it's a hypothetical metaphor. So it's hypothetical. What if we gave people an opportunity, if they went to hell, what would happen if we gave them a second opportunity to leave hell and to go into the outer limits of heaven and to be evangelized by people who were already in heaven? What would happen? Would people always choose heaven? Or might some people still choose hell? And so this is just a hypothetical what-if kind of scenario that Lewis paints. And so he has a variety of different characters that come up from hell that just have this, they're just on the outer limits, and these other people who were Christians who come back to try and talk them into staying. Some stay and some don't. And the reason why the ones who don't stay is because, according to the book, they have become the personification of the sin that sent them there. There isn't anything left of their humanity. They become the essence of the sin. There's nothing left to blow into flame. It's gone. So, in this one particular scenario, the main character is watching these other people around him, and he comes across this person here. And this person is a young man who died, who went to hell, but had a second chance, hypothetically. What would he do if he had a chance to stay? And so he says, I saw coming towards us a ghost who carried something on his shoulder. Like all the ghosts or spirits, these people who had gone before, he was unsubstantial. But they differed from one another as smokes differ. Some had been whitish. This one was dark and oily. What sat on his shoulder was a little red lizard, and it was twitching its tail like a whip and whispering things in his ear. As we caught sight of him, he turned his head to the reptile with a snarl of impatience. "Shut up, I tell you," he said. It wagged its tail and continued to whisper to him. He ceased snarling and presently began to smile. Then he turned and started to limp westward, away from the mountains and back to the way in which he had come. "Off so soon?" said a voice. The speaker was more or less human in shape, but larger than the man, and so bright that I could hardly look at him. His presence smote on my eyes and on my body, too, for there was heat coming from him as well as light, like the morning sun at the beginning of a Tyrannosaurus summer day. "Yes, I'm off," said the ghost. "Thanks for all your hospitality, but it's no good, you see. I told this little chap," here he indicated to the lizard, "that he'd have to be quiet if he came, which he insisted on doing. Of course, this stuff won't work here. I realize that, but he won't stop. I'll just have to go home." "Would you like me to make him quiet?" said the flaming spirit angel. As I now understood, of course, "Of course I would," said the ghost. "Then I will kill him," said the angel, taking a step forward. "Oh, okay, look out. You're burning me. Keep away," said the ghost, retreating. "Don't you want him killed?" "You didn't say anything about killing him at first. I hardly meant to bother you with anything so drastic as that." "It's the only way," said the angel, whose burning hands were now very close to the lizard. "Shall I kill it?" "Well, that's a further question. I'm quite open to considering it, but it's a new point, isn't it? I mean, for the moment, I was only thinking about silencing it because up here, well, it's just so embarrassing." So this is a young man who struggles with lust, and the red lizard is lust on his shoulder, okay? "Well, there's time to discuss that later." "There is no time. May I kill it?" "Please, I never meant to be such a nuisance. Please, it doesn't really bother me. Look, it's gone to sleep of its own accord. I'm sure it'll be all right now. Thanks ever so much." "May I kill it?" "Honestly, I don't think there's the slightest necessity for that. I'm sure I shall be able to keep it in order now. I think the gradual process would be far better than killing it." "The gradual process is of no use at all," said the angel. "Don't you think so?" "Well, I'll think it over, what you've said to me very carefully. I honestly will. In fact, I'll let you kill it now. I'd let you kill it now, but as a matter of fact, I'm not feeling very well today. It would be silly to do it now. I need to be good in health, for that to happen. Maybe someday, some other day perhaps." "There is no other day. All days are present now." "Get back, you're burning me. How can I tell you to kill it? You'd kill me if you did." "It is not so. Why are you hurting me?" "I never said it wouldn't hurt you. I said it wouldn't kill you." "Oh, I know. You think I'm a coward, but that isn't that. But it isn't that. Really, it isn't. I say, let me run back to the bus tonight and get an option from my own doctor, and I'll come back the first moment I can." "This moment contains all moments. Why are you torturing me? You are jeering at me. How can I let you tear me up to pieces like that? If you wanted to help me, why didn't you just kill the thing without asking me before I knew? It would be all over by now if you had." "I cannot kill it against your will. It is impossible. Have I your permission?" The angel's hands were almost closed on the lizard, but not quite. Then the lizard began chattering to the ghost so loud that even I could hear from what it was saying. "Be careful," it said. "He can do what he says. He can kill me. One fatal word from you, and he will. Then you will be without me forever and ever. It's not natural. How could you live? You'd only be a sort of ghost, not a real man as you are now. He doesn't understand. He's only cold, bloodless, an abstract thing. It may be natural for him, but it isn't for us. Yes, yes, I know there are no real pleasures now, only dreams. But aren't they better than nothing? And I'll be so good. I admit that I've gone too far in times past, but I promise I won't do that again. I'll give you nothing but really nice dreams and thoughts, and all sweet and fresh and almost innocent. You might say quite innocent. Have I your permission?" said the angel to the ghost. "I know it will kill me." "It won't, but supposing it did." "You're right. It would be better to be dead than to live with this creature." "Then may I?" "Yes, and blast you for it. Go on, can't you? Get it over. Do what you like," bellowed the ghost, ending with a whimpering, "God help me, God help me." The next moment, the ghost gave a scream of agony such as I've never heard on earth. The burning wind closed his crimson grip on the reptile, twisted it, and it bit and writhed, and then flung it, broken-backed, on the turf. It's just a great description of how people can become in bondage, and that bondage can become so compelling in their lives that it can destroy their life, and that they can rationalize themselves in terms of how they try to deal with it and how they try to wear it. And it's not just that thing. We do this in a myriad of ways throughout other areas of our life, whether it's a sense of self-worth, whether it's our body image, whether it's like how we handle our money or how we handle our anger or our emotions. We all have rationalizations about things that hold us in bondage, and as they hold us in bondage, they impede our ability to live well for Christ. They impede our ability to help others out of their bondage that prevents them from going to Christ. So I want to say, even believers can have our own special red lizard of bondage, discreetly clinging desperately. If you go on to the next slide, please. Even believers can have our own special red lizard of bondage, discreetly clinging desperately on our shoulder, incessantly, subtly, and nefariously whispering in our ear, rationalized and delightful, even necessary sins that influence our mind and our behavior. Right now, if you want to picture it, if you're really honest, and if I'm really honest, everybody here has a red lizard on their shoulder. And almost every day, he manifests himself and he speaks and he whispers and he tries to influence and he rationalizes about why we should do or say or not do and say certain things in our life on a daily basis. Now, interestingly, and I wonder if Lewis had this in mind when he wrote this particular passage of scripture. By the way, I tried to change the battery in that clock up there before I came up, and I see that it's not working. So if it's about 5 till, somebody would raise your hand, not en masse, that'll startle me. But if Rocky, if you would do that for me about 5 till, so I can, you know, wrap things up, I'd appreciate it. Okay, so the Apostle Paul describes his struggle with ongoing sin in Romans 7, verses 14 through 25. Now, this is the Apostle Paul, the second most influential person in the New Testament, perhaps in the Christian faith, aside from Jesus. And this is what he has to say about his struggles with sin in his life. And he paints it in such a way that some of the struggles put him there's a kind of bondage, a lingering bondage, where he's trying to overcome some things in his life. And so he says in verse 14, if you have your Bibles, you can look there, for we know that the law is spiritual, but I am of flesh, sold under sin. For I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Has anybody here ever had that experience? Where you said something that you shouldn't have said, you did something you shouldn't have did, you know, and you know, the irony is sometimes it happens after like this tremendous spiritual experience, you know, like right after worship or after a great, you know, devotional or whatever, and somebody says or does something, you snap at them or whatever, you're like, where did that come from? Well, it was always there. So this is what the Apostle Paul is saying. Now, if I do what I do not want, I agree with the law that it is good. In other words, the law is telling him that you shouldn't have done that. So now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. So this is the second most influential person in the history of the church saying, sin still dwells within me. It's called total depravity. That's the great theological doctrine that this is predicated on. We've been made in the image of God. We fell. That image has been corrupted. And so we can never do anything perfectly, and there's always some kind of sin working itself out in us, and that we can only get through that through the power of the Holy Spirit, who shows us, who gives us strength and power to be able to handle it. And we'll get on to that later on. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is, in my flesh. For I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. All of us here have had those experiences as Christians where you knew that this was something you should do, but it was just difficult to make it happen. And so maybe you failed, and then you had some successes. Maybe you failed a few more times, then you had more successes, but it was a process. Now, if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I who do it, but the sin that dwells in me. So I find it to be a law that when I want to do right, evil lies close at hand. So the other image is like you have the red lizard on one shoulder and you have the angel on the other shoulder and they're both speaking, you know? Sort of like that. Saying the angel saying, yeah, you really ought to think about doing this. This is what you really need to do. But the red lizard is giving you all kinds of like delicious rationalizations about why you should do this other thing instead. One of my goals here in this message is for you all to walk out of here today thinking that you have a red lizard on your shoulder. I don't want it to become pathological, but I mean, I just think that there's a helpful imagery there. So he goes on to say, for I delight in the law of good in my inner being, but I see in my members another law waging war against the law of my mind and making me captive to the law of sin that dwells in my members. Sin is always trying to captivate. It always tries to captivate, to put us in bondage. Then he goes on to say, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this bond, well, he's implying from this body of death, but you could put bondage of this, or of this body of death. Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then I myself serve the law of God in my mind, but with my flesh I serve the law of sin. So this is a very dramatic passage here. And it's been a passage of this verse 24 and 25. There's a lot of literature out there about what this means. The word wretched, talipporis, means a person in a state of severe misery, affliction, or being beaten down by continued intense spiritual strain. It implies being worn out by the struggle with a sinful nature. And Paul says, wretched man, I am tired of this. I am fatigued. I hate this thing about myself. I don't like it. It wears me out. When I grieve God because of the sin in my life, and I do it again and again and again, I just get so frustrated by it. So the overall interpretation of this passage is what Paul's saying. He says, I am now able to serve the law of God with my mind, even though my flesh gets the upper hand and takes me captive to serve the law of sin, so that I end up at times doing what I hate. We all have this. Sin always tries to captivate. It always tries to put us into bondage. Now, I want to spend a few moments on this term, the body of death. The graphic imagery of Paul's metaphor. So let me just say, when he wrote this here, anybody who would have read that passage would have raised their eyebrows. It would have just really, really gotten their attention that Paul would have used that phrase, body of death. And I've talked about this in the past, but there are a number of people here who have not heard me talk about it. And it's a very, very powerful image. And I want to spend a moment or two on this powerful image. Wretched man that I am, who will release me from this body of death? He is not talking about his physical body. He's talking about a different kind of body in a metaphorical fashion. The ancient Romans, or more precisely their predecessors, the Etruscans, practice a form of punishment where a condemned person was tied to a dead body as a method of torture and execution. The punishment of the sack was what it was called, and related practices involved shackling a living person, often a murderer, to the corpse of their victim. This was done with obsessive precision, face to face, mouth to mouth, limb to limb, creating a gruesome, intimate bond. Paul is saying, this sin is shackled to my body just like that dead body was shackled as a means of punishment to a living body. Face to face, limb to limb, creating a gruesome and intimate bond. The victim was forced to carry the decaying body, which emitted a stench and released toxins, leading to a slow, painful, and degrading death over weeks. This punishment was reserved for the most heinous crimes and was intended to be both physically excruciating and psychologically devastating. This practice is described in the ancient sources, including Virgil's Aeneid, and by French academic and Greek philosopher scholar Jacques Brunswick, and it's referenced in Christian theological writings such as Romans 7:24, where the body of death is a metaphor that draws from this Roman form of punishment. Paul is saying that the sin in his life clings to his body like this body of death. And he says, wretched man that I am. So note the graphic and powerful severity with which the Apostle Paul, if you go on to the next two slides for me, Note the graphic and powerful severity with which the Apostle Paul describes the residual nature of sin still present in his life that he is horrified by. And the question becomes, do we think of our own sin in the same way? Hit the button one more time. Do we think of our sin in the same way? Do at the end of the day or at the end of a particular event in our life, do we just say to ourselves, because of how the sin manifests itself, I'm a wretched person. Now, I'm not trying to beat up on any of us. I'm just drawing our attention to this truth, this reality in all of our lives. And that, you know, God in all of his glory, all of his holiness, all of his power, all of his love, all of those attributes with which makes God, you know, transcendent and incredible, that when we compare our life and our sin next to him, it should be like maybe almost a horrible comparison, right? And that what Christ wants us to do is to move from our current state so that we can become like him. And so what that means then is really dealing with the sin in our lives that seeks to enslave us. Next slide. When we have unresolved sin, it usually means one and or both of two things. We risk becoming enslaved to it, or we are already enslaved by it. If sin is unresolved in our life. In other words, there is a difference. There is a difference between somebody who struggles with their sin over the course of their life. They are seeking to resolve it. And a person who, like, you know what, I'm just not going to deal with it. That's just not a bad thing. I don't care about that. It's not a huge issue. I'm just going to let it lie. If that's our attitude, the second version of that, if that's our attitude, then we risk becoming enslaved to it, or we are already enslaved by it. And when that happens, it just gets in the way. It blots out part of the light of Christ in us. It robs us of our vitality in our Christian faith, so we have to drag it along behind us. It inadvertently encourages other people to continue to live in the bondage that they have in their life. So, when we have unresolved sin, we have this text here. Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin, whose sin is unresolved, is a slave to sin." Sin breeds sin. Go on to the next slide, if you would. Sin breeds sin, still more sin. Sin is always perpetually pregnant with still more sin. On a granular level, you can have a big sin and then a smaller sin in that and a smaller sin in that and a smaller sin in that. Is it five till? Okay. Thank you.
Sorry, I felt
sleepy. Yeah. So the most insidious kinds of... Now, let me just say this and then I'll conclude with this. The most insidious kinds of bondage for the believer is the one that is most obvious to others, but hidden from ourselves through denial and or spiritual blindness. And sometimes it's so obvious to you, but you want to say something to that person, but if you say something to that person, they get real defensive. Or you're just not sure you want to go through the mess of having to help them with that particular issue in their life. But the most insidious kinds of bondage for the believer is the one that is most obvious. Because if it's obvious to them, then they come to conclude that you are comfortable with that sin in your life. They assume that you're aware of it and it's just not a big deal. When it really is a big deal. So I wasn't planning to end right here, and I'm going to pick up part two next week and finish the rest of this, because I want to conclude this as a theme and as a topic. But my encouragement to all of us this morning is to have more awareness and to come to the conclusion that there is no spiritual detente. In other words, we'll leave Satan alone if he leaves us alone. Or if nobody bothers us about whatever bondage we have, we're not going to bother them. Or even a detente within ourselves. Like, well, my sins could be worse. I mean, it's not like my It's not like because I'm stingy that it's like the greatest problem in the world. It's, you know, my body image issues are mine. They don't belong to anybody else. My insecurities about this particular thing that I'm in bondage to is really my personal problem. It's really not anyone else's. We have no idea how whatever bondage we are struggling with in our life works itself out over the course of our life in ways that are really destructive to us and destructive to the kingdom. We have no idea. So all I ask is that you do this, and I will do this too. All I ask is that you pray with me today. Lord, show me. Show me those areas of my life that I'm in bondage to. In your mercy and in your grace, just show me. And I know that because you love me and that you care about me and that you are kind and merciful, I know that you will help me to overcome those areas of bondage in my life. That red lizard that's up there, that you stand ready with my permission to grab it and to destroy it so that it doesn't destroy me. And when I say that God is gracious and kind and merciful, it's truly amazing that we can have some of the things that go on in our minds and our hearts over the course of our life, that if anybody else knew how horrible that would be, but he knows everything, and he still loves us, still wants to bring us along, wants to forgive us, empower us. And not only, but this is the crazy thing, that he'll find a way to take whatever sin we were in bondage to and redeem it in a manner that advances his kingdom. How's that work? But he does.